Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Dabuti podcast. I'm Giordano Durante. Sorry it's been a while. I did warn that I wouldn't be able to create and post new episodes in a regular manner. And since my last episode in December, my three boozy Christmas tales, I've had other projects taking up my spare time. But I'm glad to be back after settling on today's topic. This is the first part of episode 5. The general theme is our relationship with the online world. Today we'll present a set of reflections about what it felt like to grow up at the beginning of the internet age, and the second part, featuring Stefano as a guest, will look at what we've lost by allowing the internet, social media, and smartphones to effectively take over our lives. So I'm following a chronology here, but a very personal one. It's not a history of technology, but a story about how the world that technology created struck me and my generation. Now, if you're my age or older, that sound will be familiar and will conjure all those frustrating attempts to connect to the internet in the mid to late 1990s. It is, of course, the noise made by the first commercially available dial-up modems as they cranked up and brought to your screens a new, garishly coloured digital world. Let me paint the picture. I think my family decided to sign up for internet access because it would help us reach information for school projects and news. I think my parents didn't want to get left behind, and we wanted the novelty of an email address for some reason, even though hardly anyone we knew had embraced this yet, and we continued to receive letters and postcards from relatives abroad for years. I don't think we could have put into words then what we hoped to get from the new technology. There was probably some unspecified desire to see what was going on, to suss it out, and ultimately, if it was unsatisfactory, to reject it and go back to our previous habits and pleasures without any fuss. Now, in those early days, you were charged for making the call that the modem needed to twang its way into cyberspace. So, to keep costs down, we'd wait until the reduced evening rate kicked in, yet another relic from those days. Additionally, you couldn't make an ordinary phone call while the modem was in use, so you had to check with all other members of the household if they needed to use the phone. So there was an element of patient ritual to all this. It had to be the right time, the landline had to be cleared for use, and you had to be willing to dedicate at least half an hour to establish the link and wait for the websites to load. Nobody really knew what they were doing, but connecting to the net was a special occasion, the whole process possessing an air of mild adventure and discovery. "Mamma, la siete en punto me voy a conectar," I remember saying, without having clear in my mind what exactly I would do once I was online. It was a curiosity, something that might or might not develop further, a bit of a lark, something to spend an hour or two on, maybe once a week. And none of us suspected it would be so transformational and, in many senses, utterly suffocating. At first, I just couldn't see the attraction. The setup was too laborious and clumsy. Lengthy phone conversations with friends were still our preferred method of communication at a distance. The phone cable stretched from the wall to under the door and into your teenage bedroom. The main memory I have is that it was comically slow and limited. You'd visit BBC News, which was launched in late 1997, maybe check your Hotmail account, and that was it. Yahoo was another popular site. It had a mix of news and features. By the time a photo loaded, however, you'd become bored or someone wanted to make a call. I think a lot of the time you connected out of duty. "Damn it, I've paid for this thing," or at least one's parents had. "I'd better use it and squeeze something out of it." The experience of surfing was very odd too, and very heterogeneous. There weren't three or four big tech companies dominating the experience. I think I used Yahoo as my search engine, but the results could lead you anywhere, maybe even an amateur website that had just been launched. Remember, and this is startling, in 1996, there were only 257,000 websites. This means that if each person in Gibraltar back then had accessed just 8 different websites in 1 hour, the entire internet would have been covered. By contrast, today there are over 1.93 billion websites. There were other things too. There was something called MIRC, a chat service, which still exists in fact, Google it, that would allow you to speak to mainly anonymous users from anywhere in the world. People from Gibraltar would chat amongst themselves in specifically created chat rooms, a very basic precursor of the WhatsApp chat rooms that bombard our phones with notifications nowadays. We would connect during those, during house parties at friends' houses, and in foreign chat rooms, we would ask strangers odd or embarrassing questions, or naively tell them we were from Gibraltar in the hope that they would know where this was. There was something exhilarating about this. The unknown stranger in a basement in Bremen reaching out to us might as well have been an alien life form. But like everything at that age, it felt like a huge joke. The internet, if anything concrete had formed in our minds by then, was an extension of our everyday humour and teasing. Only we could be wilder and more unpredictable under the cloak of anonymity. But I feel there was also an overarching, almost tender innocence about all this. This was before disagreements about politics and the culture wars and fake news had infected the online world. If you met someone online, your only worry was that they were not who they claimed they were. Maria, 18, from La Linha, was really Raul, 57, from Bogota. But at no time do I remember the nastiness, the manufactured outrage, and the sheer rudeness of today's social media interactions. It was like a light-hearted experiment, but it also felt at times like we were part of some utopian project, connecting people across borders, stunned by the novelty of the technology. I also remember, aged 18, leaving a comment under a BBC article about the Austrian elections and genuinely thinking I had made a valid contribution. It was there for years too, every time you searched for that piece, a kind of digital immortality I hadn't known before. It's exhilarating that someone sat in his room in Vineyards could write something the rest of the world might stumble across. Embarrassing too, at least looking at it with the cynical eyes of a 41-year-old. The comment is still there, in fact, and scrolling through the other contributions, I'm struck by how polite everyone is. I think that episode captured the internet too, a thrill tempered by the sense that it was all a bit naff, a passing fad, something vaguely ridiculous we'd grow out of soon and get on with the serious business of living away from our screens. Moving through the early years of the internet, I can also remember chain emails. Before we had smartphones or access to social media, we would share jokes and amusing photos via serially forwarded emails. In the first jobs I had, I remember lengthy jokes coming into my inbox that had been all around Gib. Of course, the fascinating thing was that you could see where this message had been throughout the day. Jason from Gib Telecom had forwarded it to Abigail at the tax office, who had then forwarded it to 10 people on her Yahoo contacts, and so on. It was like a slow, text-heavy WhatsApp group containing hundreds of time wasters. Also revealing is what we could not yet do online. I ordered one book on Amazon in 1999 as a test, and I wasn't booking flights or hotels yet, but still going to travel agents and getting the cheapest place, often miles away from the city centre. Nowadays, I read reviews, look at photos, take virtual tours of the room, research nearby restaurants, use Google Street View, a whole exhaustive process before opting for a hotel abroad. The internet, in other words, had not yet proven its usefulness, other than for talking to strangers and looking up amusing photos. It wasn't adventure a serious place for my generation. I hadn't taken over the world of work either. In fact, even as recently as 2007, I was in a job where most documents were still sent by fax. Those of my generation were in a unique position. Our childhoods were entirely internet-free, and yet we were aware enough and critical enough to witness the birth of the digital age. We're just about old enough to remember a time when our days and interactions weren't mediated by a screen, and the fledgling internet coincided with our late teenage years of discovery. It's a perspective that's fruitful. So-called digital natives, those who grew up in an environment saturated by the internet, don't know the comparative simplicity and silence of pre-internet days. And those who encountered the net in their 30s, 40s and 50s missed out on the youthful excitement and often puerile atmosphere of those initial online interactions. Again, though, this was not obvious to us then. As I've said, it felt like something that would be a short-lived fashion, a minority pursuit. There would be, I thought, those who would be internet users, and then a larger group, those who simply weren't. It would be optional. Of course, I was wrong. Join me for the second part of this episode, where I'll be speaking to the blogger, photographer, and cultural commentator, Stefano Blanca Chacaluga, about what we've lost since then, how the texture of our lives has been transformed by the digital revolution. Thank you very much for listening.